We're fortunate today that Rob Ambrose has joined us, a good buddy of mine for a lot of years. And some time ago, robotics at the Johnson Space Center used to be shuttle launch, if anybody remembers those days. And that after that, there was a big wave of passive exploring machines that came out of Jet Propulsion Laboratory. A lot of space is now a very new wave and a very big wave, and meets the moon and the poles of the moon in a big way, and a great deal of that is landing at Johnson Space Center. A lot of what's behind the changes is sitting right here in the room and about to go in action, so I'll give you Rob Ambrose.
Thanks, Rod. Hello, everybody. I'm going to talk to you today about a number of things. Start off with where I'm from. The Johnson Space Center was originally the manned space flight center, formed in 61. We've got about 15,000 people. And we think of ourselves as the home of human space flight, which is an interesting place for a guy in robotics to work. We have kind of a niche in robotics at JSC, which is helping astronauts do their job in space. So we compliment our buddies at JPL that build machines that go to planets where there are no humans yet. We tend to think about machines that can go with people. I'm traveling today with a number of folks from JSC. Ron Diffler and Rob Hirsch have already left for the airport, but back in the back of the room are Bill Bluthman and Chris Verdian, Ed Herrera, and Kim Hambucken. Nice mix of skills that have been going through your labs today. And of course, we're always very impressed when we come here. We've got three areas I'd like to discuss. Our general robotics R&D program we have going right now at JSC, a multi-center agency-wide program called the Human Robotic Systems Project. And then some work I'm doing on the Lunar Architecture team, looking at the spacecraft and other machines that are going to go back to the moon. So let's start with some of the machines we've built at JSC that we can consider robots. This is one that we flew in 97 called the AirCam. It's a free-flying spacecraft that was launched kind of like a Falcon is launched from a person's hands in the payload bay of the shuttle. And it flew around and provided remarkably stable images of the spacecraft. This is a smaller version we've built more recently. Called Mini AirCam, where the first AirCam was about yay big, Mini AirCam is about this big and more capable. Cold gas, 6 degree of freedom, free flyer. Both AirCams were designed principally for inspection. And when the shuttle Columbia was lost, inspection became at the front of our response. We looked at how long it would take to get the Mini AirCam flown, and it was more than 6 months. And so we were told, well, it's probably not going to be ready in time. 3 years later, we finally flew again, and we wish we had been able to get the Mini AirCam in the flow, but we're not giving up. We feel that every spacecraft that flies with humans on board should have a Mini AirCam, much like every boat should have a fire extinguisher. It should be just a fundamental thing in the spacecraft that can pop out, go around, do a self-inspection of the machine without having to do a spacewalk. We're now building a new round of spacecraft that are going to go to the moon, and we believe that self-inspection is going to be an important part of that, especially since some of the first ones won't have anybody on board at all. Here's a completely different kind of inspection machine. When we lost the Columbia, there were some small holes on the leading edge of the wings, and it would have been nice to be able to go in there and take a look. There are a lot of other structures on spacecrafts that you need to get into to place sensors, go under thermal blankets, go deep into a spacecraft. The Tendril is a kind of machine that is really inspired by deep sea creatures, where you're in a neutrally buoyant environment, a long, slender reed-like limb can go out, something we can't really understand in 1G because it would never work, but in 0G, ultra-long aspect ratios become possible. The first tendril we built was 1 centimeter in diameter and about 1 meter long. It had a very small camera on the tip. You might want to dim the lights to help the viewing, if that's possible. Let's give it a shot. Good. So here's the tendril with a 1 centimeter diameter camera going into a complicated geometry and doing an inspection. And there was a video up in the upper corner showing the camera view. The first one was, like I said, 1 meter long, 1 centimeter in diameter. And in zero-G, there really are not a lot of limits. This machine has 6 degrees of freedom. It has 2 zones at the tip. They have 2 degrees of freedom bending. There is an ejection degree of freedom, and the whole thing can rotate about its spine. So you can kind of propel it through a structure. And let's not make too many medical analogies. Here's another machine that we've built. The tendril was built in about 6 months. This is another 6-month wonder we produced. This is the SpiderKnot system. SpiderKnot was designed for a completely different class of missions. The idea was to be able to walk on a truss structure in zero-G, where that structure could be massive. It could be acres. It could be a very large macro facility, I think was the term Red used to describe such a facility. And for such a big facility, you would want it to be made with gossamer structural components, so it would be ultralight. We did a lot of climbing with some humanoid-like robots, and we found that they, like people, tended to put large forces and moments on the structure as they climbed. So we were looking for a totally different archetype of machine that could climb with very light loads, and ideally no moments. So you would need at all times at least 3 points of contact so that there would be no moments imparted on the structure. So we looked to the spider as an ideal archetype with a redundant set of points of contact that could walk across that structure. Here's another shot just to give you a sense of scale. SpiderKnot, well, she's a very big bug, 600 pounds. And a 600-pound arachnid can go pretty much wherever a 600-pound arachnid wants to go. But she won't go fast. This is a very slow, methodical, force-controlled machine. Here are baby's first steps. We've got it on an air-bearing floor, so it's kind of like on an air hockey table, except the puck's blowing air down. If you push it, it just floats with 3 degrees of freedom of frictionless motion. We've lifted it up on a hydraulic jack, so its feet are off the ground, just to check it out. And then we put her down on the ground and started taking our first steps. And we've been playing around with different gaits. My favorite gait is one that keeps all 8 legs down as the body moves forward and then lifts 2 at a time while the body continues in a constant velocity. That control mode was enabled with a set of software we developed called the Gait Engine that would basically let you fly the body. So the body has 6 degrees of freedom within the range of the motion limits of the legs, and would basically manage the gating algorithm, the rhythms, to allow you to fly the body and do what you wanted to do. So the body could lift up and down off the plane. It could roll, it could yaw, and it could walk left and right, as well as fore and aft. Here it's got some just rubber tennis shoe feet on it. We swapped out different kinds of feet. There's some truss work in the back that we put some nodes on, and we're able to walk with kind of a ball and socket foot. And we did a coordination experiment with the tendril and the SpiderKnot system, as well as a JPL robot called Lemur. And Sanjeev and graduate Fred helped us with some coordination software to kind of sequence the machines through an assembly task. This assembly team was really focused on zero-G, and this was about 2 years ago. Since then, we've really been directed to go to the surface and stop horsing around in zero-G as much, though I believe once the complete architecture of how to get to the moon becomes apparent, we will see a lot of complicated orbital docking, rendezvousing, servicing, reconfiguration, and I think that NASA will start to have, again, a strong interest in zero-G work.
Professor,
yes?
Doesn't the gait that you described impart some twisting motion?
It does not, because This gate would be bad for 1G, but in 0G, every pair of legs was butterflying. And so the idea was that you would not have the wagging that you would get if you did one at a time. Now, in a gravity environment, you would never want to lift your front two legs at the same time because you would reduce your footprint.
I'm talking about when with the joints there, I don't see how when all eight are down,
right,
you can go forward without some twist at the level.
So you can have twists like this,
okay,
about that axis. And for climbing on the trusses, we had ball and sockets that were frictionless. So by the design, they could capture with only forces applied, no moments, which is what we want, because a structure that is designed to react moments has to be much stronger, much heavier, rather, and we don't want that. So a spider is well-suited for walking on a gossamer structure like a web. Now, when you go from a machine like this that had to move its own legs in 1G to be demonstrable, you'd really scale it up and probably go from like a wolf spider to more of a daddy long legs like kinematics. Totally different machine. Tell me how this works. It's the first prototype had a gerbil, but we got in trouble for that. So we had to build a robot version of it. This machine is characterized by a short life. By the patch on it, you can see that the balls gets popped easily. The idea is that it would drive out to some site, pop, and deploy its payload. The ball it's a very inexpensive project. We built it on a shoestring. The ball is available at Toys R Us, aisle 3, 1995. we would build it, we would put a ball on it, and we'd drive it until it popped. And depending on how you drove it, your mileage would vary. How does that work? Turns out it's a very simple machine. You can kind of see something inside. There's between those two plates, left and right, is a pipe, and it's an ultra light pipe, like a beer can of a pipe. And hanging from the pipe is rigidly connected to those flanges. Hanging from that pipe is a pendulum, and the pendulum has 2 degrees of freedom. It can lift up, and it can do that continuously, which causes the ball to roll, because the pendulum actually doesn't go all the way over usually. And then the pendulum can lean left and right. The nice thing about this is it can pack very tight and then inflate. And it's very light. The design, I'll show you when this ends, the design specs we had for it. It was actually manufactured for about, with the computers, maybe $1,000. I had a co-op do it. The idea has been around for a while. Doing it with an inflatable ball was kind of a new idea. And it's quite peppy. Let me show you what's inside. Hanging on that pipe is a pendulum. The green roller blade wheels are just in case it ever hits an object that causes the ball to flex and strike the pendulum. You want it to roll, not pitch. But those are just passive wheels. And it's all made, we actually built it with FIRST Robotics parts. So we had some guys who had worked on a FIRST Robotics project, and it was all made out of those parts. I was kind of stuck on the number 20 for this project. 20 kilogram mass, able to drive 20 kilometers in 20 minutes for a Mars environment. Wind drag is the key thing here. But I said I would settle on Earth with Houston Air for 20 miles an hour. It can go over a 20 centimeter step and it can climb a 20 degree slope, which if you were to plot those metrics for most vehicles, it's off the chart. And that's because wheel diameter is really important in specifying how big of an object you can go over. And this thing is all wheel. So it is the wheel. And you can see the ball's very simple construction. So the idea is that the payload bay is the pipe. And you drive out, you'd fall off the spacecraft, you'd inflate, you'd drive out 20 kilometers, maybe up a hilltop, you'd pop, you'd deploy your repeater antenna, and the robot's, the end of the robot's mission is to have deployed that payload. Another robot you may have heard of at JSC is the Robonaut system. Here's a history of our Robonaut development. We've been building the Robonauts now for over a decade. We've really had our first milestone in 98. Back then, I got to do a lot of fun and really fun engineering. I built that arm up in the top left. I was the arm subsystem lead. And Ron Diffler, who traveled with us, is the hand subsystem lead. We built up a first limb, and with a teleoperated system, discovered we could really grab stuff like no robot we'd ever seen before. It could reach out and grab objects, could work with hand tools. We knew we really had something when we were able to work with, say, forceps and wire cutters. So we decided to build a full dual-arm system based on that limb, and over a few years, we had Robonaut 1A fully integrated with a waist that could move around a little bit. At that time, actually a little before that, around 2000, Red and I wrote a proposal to put this on Nomad and make this thing mobile, get it out of the lab. And I continued to push that because I thought it would be an important mobile manipulation system. Well, it took us several years to build Robonaut 1A, and that robot has a big rack of computers and is unlikely to ever leave that lab. In 2002, we knocked out Robonaut 1B, a very portable system. All that rack of electronics was packaged in the torso. We didn't let the torso grow. We went ahead and added a stabilizing leg, but as years went on, we found that there were lots of lower bodies that were really interesting for the Robonaut system. We did some zero-G climbing on an air sled. We paired a couple Robonauts with my favorite astronaut, Nancy Curry. We lopped off the leg and put it on a Segway we got from DARPA. That was hilarious and kind of scary. But boy, we jumped on it, and it was a lot of fun. We really got into mobile manipulation pretty seriously there. But one of the things that was unsatisfying about the system was it just couldn't touch the ground. It could do all kinds of tricks with its hands and tools, but if it dropped one, it had to ask a person to come over to do something. So Robonaut 1B has been very mobile. We've put it on lots of other lower bodies. Robonaut 1A has continued with its big rack of computers to be our autonomy system, and that's where we've done almost all our autonomy research. Whenever we get something working well, we port it to the younger brother, and it gets kind of a instant upgrade. The most recent thing we've done with the portable one is we mounted it on a new base to form what we call the Centaur configuration. And I'm going to show you a little bit more about that in a bit. So let's change gears. We've got an agency-wide program looking at human robotic systems. It's out of the Exploration Systems Mission Directorate. We've got a number of R&D projects, and we're just one of them. There's propulsion and life support and power, and they're loosely grouped into the in-space spacecraft launch systems and surface systems. So as you can tell, you know, we're pretty interested in the surface, though we think orbital operations around that new spacecraft are going to be important too. And the way they've structured is they say for a given technology to go to the moon, it has to be at a certain technology readiness by a certain advanced date, typically a preliminary design review. And so we're really trying to get the right technologies matured now so that we can get them in place so that they can be picked up by the flight programs and taken to the moon. Whenever you've got people involved in a spacecraft, the program is rightly very conservative. And so if I tell them that I've got this great idea, they get nervous. And if I tell them it'll only take 3 years, but I'm not really sure, that they get downright frightened. So what we really have to do is just show them. We have to build the machines and demonstrate them in pretty tough environments before they're willing to risk astronauts' lives on them. And that's perfectly reasonable. So that's our job. I mentioned lots of other technology programs to get to the moon. There's all kinds of technology that is needed. And so robotics is a part of it, but we're competing with a lot of other technologies, and that's fine. When it comes down to it, the robots are a lot more exciting than the in-flight waste recovery system. So we have a lot of advantages, and I'm taking full advantage of every one of them. We've got the way I've structured our group, we've got a number of tasks, and we've got leads from all these different centers. Ames, who's Terry Fong, the CMU grad, Johnny Caruso at Glenn, Jill McGuire, formerly Jill Holtz at Goddard, Paul Schenker at JPL, I'm at JSC, John Dorsey at Langley, and Rob Mueller at KSC. And Chris Colbert has been our project manager, though he's currently on assignment to headquarters, so I've been leading the overall project. We've got a number of different tasks, and you're going to see a couple of those here shortly. Our biggest one in 06 was a coordinated field test, where we took a number of different robotic systems out to the Flagstaff area around Meteor Crater, and each of these represented an important task for us. What we wanted to do was to kind of show a snippet of how robots could be working with humans on the surface of the moon, and in particular, I wanted to avoid the classic problem of having a robot in direct series with the astronaut, where the astronaut's waiting for the robot to do something, hissing, burning air. Don't want to ever put the robot in the critical path of the astronaut if they're slow. And generally, robots are pretty slow in a lot of the things we do. There are some things where they're off the chart fast, like welding, but for a lot of what we do, the humans are a lot quicker than the robots. So I really wanted to look at how you could find different jobs that are the right kind of jobs where the robot would actually improve the overall efficiency of the team, not just be kind of an interesting demonstration that would tick the astronauts off, and for the good reason that they were having their time wasted. So we came up with a number of different things that the robots could do that were very efficient. We did some interesting cargo repositioning. One of the robots picked up a giant module and moved it around, and people aren't going to do that. We did a lot of work from so-called ground control, where we operated these robots across a pretty good time delay from Houston, emulating the Earth to Moon time delays, which are on the order of about 5 to 10 seconds, probably. So all the robots really had to have low levels of competency that you could just basically supervise them, saying, pick that up, or put it over there, or drive over here without running over anybody, and be able to trust the machines to do those things, not minutes out, but maybe tens of seconds out, and keep them running efficiently, kind of like a supervisor would. And then we did some interesting driving and rappelling down some steep embankments that were kind of fun. These were the players. From Ames, we had a number of K-10 robots. This is K-10 Blue. I think there were as many as 4 K-10s. From JSC, we had the Scout vehicle, which is a lunar rover test bed. We also had the Centaur, a Robonaut 1B mounted on a new base we built. We have some advanced space suits. These are actually two different suits we were kind of comparing and contrasting in the field. We have a pressurized module that had donning stations inside where the astronauts could go in and get charged. And we had this wild machine from JPL called Athlete. I'll talk about each. K-10 was an inspection robot. It had a number of different camera technologies on board. It had the ability to take images at different levels of exposure and then build a mosaic. One of the problems in space is the lighting is extreme. It's either too dark or too light, and when you take a single shot, you either have deep, dark shadows that you can't see into, or everything is washed out. The guys at Ames developed a kind of a mosaicing of different photos from different exposure levels that were able to give a very insightful picture, and we were able to use it to self-inspect some of the other machines. The Athlete system was built by a colleague of mine at JPL named Brian Wilcox and his group. There are actually two units built. It's a hexagonal ring. It weighs 1,800 pounds. Each leg has 6 degrees of freedom, plus a 7th degree of freedom, which is a wheel. It has the ability to reach up over on its back and pull off implements. So at the time, a couple of the legs had these tool changeout devices, so they could pick up grippers or pick up really big anchor screws. And with all six legs in collaboration, it could pick up very large modules like that pressurized rover compartment and drive them across the desert and park them in place. So for example, if the crew needed a quick recharge of their suit, athlete could position a pod just in the right spot. The Centaur system has that dexterous upper body and a really nice waist that you're going to see in action here that allows it to get those arms down on the ground. The task that we gave it was to drive up to the tailgate of the Scout system and pull a box off. And it did that with a high degree of autonomy, where it was driven close and then it found Scout, docked kind of kinematically with Scout using stereo vision, found the box, grasped the box using tactile perception on its hands, and the waist also has the ability to spin around, and it's got a neat little workbench on its hindquarters for setting objects. The Scout Rover is about a 2,800 pound 1G version of the Apollo Lunar Rover. It has a lot of COTS technology, a lot of off-the-shelf technology that we're trying out for working with crew. It's got the roll bar looks like an antenna farm for a reason. It's got all kinds of different cameras and microphones and human trackers when the crew dismount, tracking where they are around the machine. It also has, it's a robot. It can be driven from onboard like a truck, but when you dismount, it can follow you using stereo vision. It actually has the Robonaut vision system ported to it. It can be given as GPS, so it can be given waypoints and told to go there, or when it's driven to some place, it can record that location and drive back later. And it can, of course, be teleoperated from either IVA right now or in the future with that ground control capability. And it can carry two suited subjects. These guys weigh a lot. They're carrying 225 to 250 pounds on their backs while on them. And in 1G, it's pretty punishing. This step, we had to add that. They just could not make it up. And it's like a 14-inch step. They just could not do that 14-inch step. Now, in 1.6G on the moon, they could jump over this thing if they got a running start, right? So it's very difficult to emulate lunar conditions and do good testing. We have a lot of compromises, but people don't really come in different sizes. If we tried to use 18-month-old humans because they're about 1/6 size, we wouldn't really get the test results that we wanted. So things don't always scale, and you have to come up with intelligent ways to do the similitude and still stay focused on what you're after. Here we were looking at different ways that the crew could be supported by somebody at Mission Control who was reading through their EVA procedure, but they're on the other side of time delay and figuring out a good CONOPS approach for doing field work. There was that crew module. Inside it were these docking rings, and when the astronauts have been walking in 1G for a while, they're basically exhausted. And the suit's really beating them up. They lose fingernails, and it really tears them up. So when they're doing a suit recharge, they dock with this ring around the belly bearing ring, and it allows them to take all the weight off, and they can kind of rest. So they were pretty eager to get up in there and plug in. They got a recharge and a little bit of a break. So here's the sequence we went through. We wanted to take kind of a snapshot of an activity that might occur on the surface of the moon and look at different robotic capabilities to make that happen. The first step was that the athlete would position that rover compartment out in the desert. Second step, two crewmen coming in from an EVA would pull up alongside, dismount, and climb up into the compartment on top of athlete. While they're in there getting charged, K-10 and Centaur went into kind of a pit crew service. Centaur went up, pulled the sample box off, and K-10 did a 360 inspection of the rover. And then the crew by then had recharged came out, hopped in, and went off to the next part of their mission. And the important part of that was that the crew and the robots were never really in series. We came up with an intelligent way to split them in parallels. We didn't waste their time. Here's a 2-minute clip that shows that sequence. See there, Scout's a four-wheel drive, four-wheel steer, LRV-like system. Watch how hard it is for this guy to get in that door. And that's a really big door. The lunar excursion module had a 32-inch diameter tunnel they had to climb through, and they got stuck. So in 1G, it's a lot harder. Plus, he's carrying an antenna farm on his back. Here comes the Centaur system. We were demonstrating a number of different control modes. Here we were doing teleoperation where we would just run it right at objects that are out in the desert, and it would follow you up to a point and then say, and avoid them. And if it could, if you were running at full speed, it would stop. If you're going at about half speed, it would intelligently veer around them. Once it got close, it kind of docked on its own. The people back in Houston would just authorize that it had done what it thought it had done and move on to the next task. It found that box first with stereo vision, then with tactile grasping, and then haptically getting an opposing grasp that would not let it go. And it spun around and put it back on its little workbench. That lower body was built in about 4 months last year. We started it in January, and it was driving by the end of April. By June, we had mounted Robonaut on it. So once Centaur gets out of the way, the K-10 goes into service. It's using that mosaicing software and some digital cameras to take a 360 inspection of the Scout machine and verify that it's the way Mission Control thinks it is before they send people back out into the field. I'm going to go ahead and stop it there. While we were there, we decided to try something else. We hadn't practiced this at all, but since we got a bunch of robots together in the field, and they'd never been together before, we thought we'd use it as an opportunity. And we had the other athlete off to the side during this experiment, and it climbed up a hilltop that was extremely steep. The final steps were literally stepping up crags. Centaur drove up the other side, which was not quite as steep, and we got him up on the hilltop, and we decided we would do a rappel. And at least did the first part of this up at the top, where we set up the belay, set up the anchor, and initiated the rappel. In December, the athletes came to the Johnson Space Center, and we've got a small hill on the back 40 at JSC. And we did the full thing where it actually did the rappel down the hilltop. So the sequence was that Centaur approached athlete and extracted a tether hook. It's actually an EVA tether hook off of the side of athlete and extracted it. Then athlete pulled one of those giant drill augers anchors off of its holster and drilled that into the hilltop. Then backed away, and Centaur came in. So it's holding a line that's running through the athlete. It hitched it up, and then the athlete started the rappel. So here's a 2-minute video of that sequence. You see one of the athlete's legs is up near its tool holster, which gave a nice open bay for Robonaut to go in. We actually were experiencing just horrible weather out there. It was very wet. And we discovered that Centaur could duck underneath the athlete, and we could tarp it. And when the rainstorms would stop, we'd pull it off. And the robots fit nicely together. Centaur wisely is getting out of the way, because this thing is big. And the general rule is if all the wheels are pointed in the same direction, be advised. And if they're pointing at you, be afraid. It can do 10 kilometers an hour. And when it's angry, kind of scary. So it has the ability to really lean on any one of those legs. So when it gets that auger into position, it can put some pretty mighty force. As I said, the whole vehicle weighs 1,800 pounds. And it's in near kind of a singularity, like doing a push-up. So it has the ability to put a lot of load on that drill. And that's just a huge drill. That's like a yard long. It's got an eye at the top. It has a quick change device, and it's got this nifty little pair of stereo cameras that look at whatever tool it's about to grasp. So then Centaur is still standing off to the side with the leash. Athlete rolls out of the way, and then we have the Centaur system come in. Now this is being done completely teleoperatively, and you'll see why. This is a very sophisticated kind of eye-hand coordination task, and we're going to get it. We're going to get to the level of being able to automate this, but we're not there yet. Right now, the robot is much better teleoperatively than autonomously. Now, it's interesting. I cut the video here. When it let go, the cable just flipped over on that carabiner. That's actually the EVA tether hook that all astronauts use as their kind of lifeline. It's like a carabiner. It just flipped over and just tangled itself in a knot. And in about 30 seconds to a minute, the teleoperator basically untwisted it and let it go. And that's an important note, because in space, if it can go wrong, it will. And ropes and tethers and things like this just tend to snag in the worst possible way. And it's nice to have a little finesse.
What was the teleoperator time like?
Quarter. Bill, what would you say the delay was between the teleoperator station and the robot?
This was from a local habitat site. So from the equivalent inside habitat module.
Yeah. So a quarter of a second maybe at the most. If that, right?
What are they looking at? Are they looking through cameras?
Yes.
Or are they standing next to it?
Oh, no. They're back in a trailer. They can't see the robot. They can't hear or anything, but we've got all kinds of force feedback gadgets and visual displays and overlays, but it has stereo vision, has four cameras, two that are machine vision, and then two that are just broadcast for teleoperation. And it's just so natural to step into this machine and teleoperate that you really don't need a whole lot. We also just took it out for a spin. We wanted to just practice doing the coordination of the upper body and the lower body for mobile manipulation. And we'd done that demonstration where we were grasping the box with a high level of autonomy, but we wanted to just get a feel for how you do the general algorithm of bending and picking. So you're trying to coordinate the dexterous hands, the vision, the mobile base, and this mid-body that allows you to sweep the head and the arms around as a kind of a dexterous sweet spot. The machine is actually fast. Top speed is probably on the order of 10 to 20 miles an hour. And I won't let them drive it that fast with Robodon on it. We typically would drive it around like 5 miles an hour, and you're jogging after it. So he has some rock in mind. And again, this is a pure teleoperation. He had spotted some rock, so now he's going to try and coordinate how he's going to get his hand on it. And we're just so good at that. We see something, and we know how long our arm is, and we've already decided, am I going to pick it up with my right arm or my left arm? And all this are just natural decisions that we make. We aren't shaped quite like this. So when he saw that rock, he kind of guessed wrong about where he needed to position himself. Here's one of the eye views, reaching out and grabbing the rock. There he's positioning the base a little bit to give him a shot at it. You see his view is pretty narrow. I mean, he can't see his elbow typically. So they pretty much are just flying their hands around, and they don't really care what's making the hands move. They look down and they see their hands, and they're trying to position them to do work. And you notice that it's all suited, and that's because we have to keep it clean, and we really believe in that. This is a one-piece suit we built for the summer field exercise. The previous suits were all segmented with bearings, just like the space suit. In fact, it's the same outer garment as the outer garment of the space suit. But we decided when we were going out to the field that we wanted to go with a one-piece design. Since it's not positively pressurized with an 8 PSI differential, it's not so turgid. So we were able to make it fairly soft. We did, and it was very clean. It's got a polypropylene liner with Ziplocs underneath the outer garment that you see. We did a post-mortem when we got back to Houston, and the interior was very clean. It was slightly positively pressurized, which is a cheat that we can't do on the moon, but we could certainly do it on Mars. But there's some ducted fans in the backpack, and when you walk up to it, you could feel air blowing out of the sleeves. So it was all positively, slightly positively pressurized, and it stayed very clean. So here is an eye view. It's turned kind of bass-ackwards, and it can drive that way. And in fact, if it kind of leans over that rear workbench, it's kind of like a person on a Japanese sport bike leaning over. The CG is actually best when it's rearward. And this year, we're putting a new suite of sensors on the rear bumper for higher speed autonomous driving. And we think that'll be rear facing. All right, I'm just going to switch this. This was a great field team. We had them out there in September. I don't think they were really thinking about it too much, but yes, they did.
Is that something you see consistently? Or is
yeah, they like to keep an eye on where their hands are.
It's like a,
so, yeah, like a gun sight, so they're trying to use that to drive. It's an interesting idea. We haven't really driven it that much to know, but that's an interesting idea. We had a great field team. The last topic was going to be just briefly about our lunar architecture team. We're looking at the south pole of the moon. There's a big crater there called the Shackleton Crater. On the perimeter of this crater are a number of hilltops. We have our eye on one in particular. They look like topo lines, but these are actually sun lines. So what you want on the south pole is year-round light. So as the sun goes around you, if you're up on a hilltop, you're always getting the sun. Now, it's horizontal, but you're getting year-round sun. With the beta angle between the moon and the Earth, there are times when it will drop below the horizon. And so the higher the hill you're on, the better likelihood you have of year-round sun. There's also a nice spot here that always has a look at the Earth. And with the moon and with synchronicity with the Earth, you know, that is always looking at the Earth. And is a great place to set up a comm terminal, so you can always have communication with the Earth. And we're looking at this hilltop as a site for our habitation area, a landing zone off to the side, and a resource area for doing some excavation to get some materials for producing hydrogen and water, maybe some metals. We're looking at a number of different sequences, but the most important thing here. So these are all the different landers that would go starting in around 2019. And this is just a lot of equipment. And the most important thing for me is that it's all going to the same spot. In Apollo, we peppered the surface with all these different landers, which is great for a scientific exploration, where any overlap would be waste. You'd not want to have any overlap to get maximum coverage. But this time, we're going back to set up an outpost. And so the ability to accrue assets in one spot really opens up a lot of opportunities. This hill that they're climbing, number of cumulative days on the surface of humans, whenever you see a flat line, that's a lander that came down without any people on board. And in between, like the first few human missions, are only there for a couple weeks at a time. This is a fantastic opportunity for robotics. You'd be going back over and over again, so dropping a robot at the site has the potential of being used for years to do many different jobs. And in between crews, when there's nobody available to do any work, the robot can get some things done. Each human crew could leave the robots with a to-do list. There could be caretaking. There could be some new state that over the next 6 months, the robots have to get all this equipment moved into a construction site. So when the next crew comes down, it'll all be in the right spot, ready for them to do the next phase of construction. The red modules at the top for this architecture are four different habitat modules that come down. And if you follow the lines, each of these landers has different assets that pop out various rovers and solar arrays and comm terminals that pop out accruing. Each of these is dropping on the order of 45 metric tons to the surface total. So you're really collecting a lot of gear. And robotics is going to be a big part of it. Here is the latest lander design. It's designed for a 10-meter shroud. So the shroud on the rocket is 10 meters in diameter. So it's generally wider than it is tall because we're using such a large shroud. So this is one of those habitat modules. And we're looking at ways to offload it. It weighs on the order of 6 metric tons. So we're looking at these rovers that could be used in various combinations to pick up and move that large package. The landing zone is likely on the order of 2 kilometers away from the habitat zone, and it's probably going to be uphill to the habitat zone. So the machines have to have the wherewithal to pick these, to somehow get these payloads offloaded from the lander and to make it up the hill. So that's one approach where you build your habitat out of pieces, kind of space station-like. This is a completely different approach. This is based on the athlete concept, where every single lander coming down is exactly the same. And it's an intriguing approach, and we're comparing the two for key parameters of mass and reliability. The interesting part about this is they land, there is an ascent module on it. You would probably not even fire you would probably not move it around until the crew left on the ascent module, because if you tip this over as you're driving it around, your ride home is on it. So you would be extremely cautious driving this around until you went home. But once you went home, the ascent module was about 6 or 7 metric tons, so it's gotten a lot lighter. And now, robotically, it could drive up the hill and dock with all the other landers. And the idea is you would dock them one after the other. And in this architecture, you would basically eat your way through them, where the ones that are empty now become airlocks or science labs. And you keep bringing up new ones that are full of, like pantries full of provisions. And eventually, the first one gets filthy because it's being used as the airlock. And as my friend Brian Wilcox likes to say, you could then send it down into the salt mines to do work as you bring new ones. And as you saw, lots of landers would be going to the moon, and so we could send them off for that kind of service. So that concludes my talk. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them now. We've got about 10 minutes in the schedule, and I'm at your disposal. Right there.
So robot looks like a human, and I assume that that's so that humans can easily anthropomorphize and control the device. But it only looks kinetically like a human. Dynamically, gear motors don't act like muscles, but we know that muscles are really important, and the dynamics of human are important for manipulation tasks. So do you have some comments about how that works with robot? Maybe some difficulties, maybe why it doesn't matter in space.
Well, if you watch the robonauts move, it's kind of like a slow underwater ballet. They move slowly. And there's a reason for that. If I was your robot assistant and you said, give me the tool, you wouldn't want the robot to say, here you go. Because that's dangerous, especially if it's sharp. You'd want it to go slowly and deliberately, and you can kind of anticipate where it's going and stay out of its way, because robots are dangerous. They hurt people. Typically, they're kept in cages, and I mean literally, and like if you go into an automotive facility, they're in cages. And if you want the robots to be trusted around people, they need to be soft and padded and smart and sensate, and not moving so fast is a reasonable additional safety. But having said that, we want them to go faster. And that means we're just gonna have to be softer and more padded and more smart and more tactile and more sensate to make up for the fact that they're going to be going faster. And the Robonaut 2 series is now in design at JSC, and it's faster and it's stronger and it's more dexterous and it's more sensate and it's more intelligent. And you'll be seeing it in the next year or so. It will have more elastic-like actuation. It will have a great deal more sensing in its drivetrains. But, you know, one Robonaut limb has about 150 sensors today. So, but the sky's the limit. It's going to get an even higher sensor count, and it will be much more compliant in the way that it interacts with the environment. Yes?
There's been some press recently.
Actually, but there's another reason it looks like a human, and that's because we're pretty darn good. It's not just because it makes it easy to use. It turns out that small arms on a waist that's mobile are very effective compared to a giant base-mounted long arm system. Small arms that you can move around with your good visual intersection with that workspace, it's a fantastically powerful mobile manipulation system. So there's another reason. I didn't copy the appendix. You know, there are a lot of things that aren't in it that are from humans, but there's a lot that's right with human design, and we went for that. I'm sorry.
There's been some press recently about the Chinese Space Agency announcing a 20 or 30 year plan to harvest helium-3 from the lunar dust. Excellent thermonuclear fuel. So there's a mission there. That's going to take some very big machines. And two questions are still there. One, are you going to be tripping over them? And secondly, what's the equivalent U.S. mission?
So you saw the dates on our lunar architecture. They were first landing around in the late teens.
Yeah.
And we definitely want to go there and not find barbed wire around the South Pole. You know, that would be a problem. Robonaut can use wire cutters, and we could get through that. But let's be serious. We want to go there. We think that there's some strategic advantages to that site, and we don't want to let our schedule slip out to the point that we find a civilization already built there, and we're tourists. You know, we want to get there. If in fact that is the right spot strategically to go, we'd like to go there and prove that. We'd like to lead the way, not just follow. And the camera is running, so that's all I'm going to say.
Rob, yes. I wonder, with this mobile manipulation, since the operator is controlling the torso and the base, do they ever have a problem of trying to resolve the redundancy?
Absolutely. When we were doing that autonomous docking where we kind of came in, it wasn't a mechanical docking, it was just a logical docking where we had came into the right location to do the grasp. It was very sequential. We were really, first we'd drive into the right location knowing how long our arms are, and then we stop, and then we move the arms out, and then we would do fingers, and then we would rotate around, and that's very unsatisfying to me. So even when it's an autonomous system doing it, it's not as unified. It should be, you know, one sweeping motion. And you know, we've got a lot to figure out to make that happen. And the robot has, with left and right hands, you know, it's got the whole logic of handedness of, I see an object, it's just obvious I should pick it up with my left hand, even though I want to use it in my right hand, and all the logic of how to do that is just a beautiful problem that has to be solved. But moving the robot into an area doing work, moving somewhere else and doing work, the humans do it very efficiently. Yes, they had to still do a little micro navigation and bump around, but autonomously we're not there yet. You know, it's frontier to figure out how to position that system to do work, and all the logic of working with multiple limbs and objects is fascinating to me, and it needs a lot of work. But you know, we're not there yet. Any other questions?
Rob mentioned that crater at the South Pole, and we've had our eye on it for a decade. One of the interests is that it's believed to be a mother lode. to co-develop a machine over the next couple of months that would show the idea of driving and drilling. It's not an advertisement, it's just that we ought to get together every once in a while, and things happen so fast around here that it's over before it gets started. So, you know, if anybody's interested in running after that, let us know. And then the dream would be to get out there or get down in a crater somewhere here.
So, if you look at that lander sequence, pick your ride. Each one of those things can deposit 19 metric tons of cargo, and I believe there's got to be some margin in there somewhere. For
the trouble is, the challenge of space is always getting there, and the trick is always being ready.
Right.
Because when the ride is right, everyone's always looking for the right thing to do. One of the inevitable things that robotics will do to settle the question of volatiles and water and characterize it. And to, that's one of those very predictable discoveries yet to be done.
Well, that's about our best image of that crater.
That spot is about as close as you get.
Yeah. So we don't really, in that big black void, you know, we don't know what's in there very well. And we're going to get a slightly better look at it in the next couple of years with the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter that's going to be going into a polar orbit imaging with a number of different sensors. But we'll still only be down in the 30-centimeter range. So we're not going to have a super high-quality map. Plus, so when you go down in there, it's permanently dark. Whatever is inside there has never seen the sunlight. And we're excited about what might be there, Red.
Well, we're all so excited to have had everyone from JSC up for a day. Pretty neat. And that never happens enough. The trip around here is to start on time and end on time. Thanks so much. Really tossed gearheads from around here. Just ask whether anybody had a bit of it.